True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
How can I please report a call, Sergeant Walsh?
Hi, this is Priscilla Matarazzo. I'm calling because my daughter moved to Hopkinton about a week ago.
Yes.
I haven't heard from her in 2 days, and I was up there today. She was expecting me, and there was nobody there, and I just heard from her girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
She was expecting for supper tonight, and there's no one there. We can't reach her by cell phone, and it's really unusual for her to do this.
Okay, what's her name, ma'am?
It's Rachel Entwistle and her husband, Neil.
Okay, hang on a minute. Rachel
Entwistle, E-N-T-W-I-S-T-L-E.
Okay, and her husband's Richard?
No, Neil.
Neil, I'm sorry, same last name?
Yes.
Okay, and what type of vehicles does she have? Do you know that?
They have a white BMW R3.
Okay, is it registered to either one of them?
It's registered to Rachel.
Okay. All right.
There's a 9-month-old baby.
Okay. And I know that's kind of a, there's not many houses up there, so, and you said she just moved in a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Do you know if she's happened to met the neighbors or anything yet, or would it
I don't think, no, she hasn't mentioned that she had met the neighbors yet.
And if we make contact, you just wanted to have your daughter give you a call?
Yes.
Okay.
Now, Joanna and her sister Maureen are still at the house.
Okay.
Outside and, you know, waiting in the driveway.
Okay. Does the house have a garage on it?
Yes, it does.
Okay. And they were supposed to, her sister was supposed to be over there for dinner tonight?
Joanna, her girl, no, her girlfriend, Joanna.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I said it was her sister. Okay.
Yeah, no. I was there today. She was expecting, I haven't been able to reach her by cell or the house phone since 10 o'clock this morning. Both Joanna and I last heard from her, spoke to her on Thursday.
Okay, and everything was fine then?
Yeah.
Okay. Does the garage have windows in it?
No.
No windows?
No. And there is a dog, Sally. She's a Basset Hound, and we've heard her barking.
All right, what we'll do is the dog's barking, we'll send somebody up there and take a peek. Ground floor windows, were you able to see in any of the windows or anything?
No. Blinds are all drawn.
Okay.
All right, and to get around on the basement floor, there's a slider. I could see in there, and Neil has an office down there.
Okay.
There were no lights on. As Joanna said, there's a light on in the hallway down there. He can't see in any other.
All right, and it was confirmed for the dinner engagement tonight.
Yeah.
You're telling me?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. The last time you spoke with her, everything seemed all right? She didn't tell you that she was going away unexpectedly or anything like that?
No.
No? Okay.
She's the type of girl that calls me whenever she does anything.
Sure. Okay. Okay. We'll send somebody up. We'll check it, and then I'll give you a call back and let you know how we make out.
All right, thank you.
Okay, you're entirely welcome. Bye. Bye.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick. Just a quick note before we begin. Since I broke my foot, Jill has had to take on some of my usual tasks around the house, mostly involving walking the dogs. We live in a pretty safe area, but having Sabre safety products has given both of us an added sense of security. This holiday season, give the gift of safety with Sabre, the number one brand of pepper spray trusted by police and consumers worldwide. Sabre makes maximum strength pepper spray and gel, as well as other great devices to help us feel safe, including personal alarms and window and door sensors. Go to sabre.com/truecrimebrewery and use code TRUECRIME to get 20% off your order. That's sabre.com/truecrimebrewery.
Thanks, Dick. The bodies of 27-year-old Rachel and 9-month-old Lillian Entwistle were found on January 22nd, 2006, in the master bedroom of their Hopkinton, Massachusetts home, where the Entwistles had been living for only 10 days. Autopsy results would show that Rachel died of a gunshot wound to the head, and baby Lillian died of a gunshot wound to her stomach. Just hours after the deaths of his wife and his daughter, Neil Entwistle purchased a one-way ticket to London and boarded a British Airways flight. On January 23rd, Hopkinton police located Neil at the home of his parents in Nottinghamshire, England. He told the detective that he left his home at around 9 a.m. 3 days earlier to run an errand, and that his wife and daughter were both alive and well and in the couple's bed when he left. When he returned at around 11 a.m., he claimed to have found both had been shot dead. He then covered the bodies of his wife and daughter with a blanket and left the house. He did not call for help. So Neil Entwistle's behavior after his family was killed brought a lot of suspicion upon him. What detectives discovered in their subsequent investigation was completely unexpected. For a young professional couple living an apparently charmed life, what went on behind closed doors and on the Entwistle's computer was very disturbing. If being a shitty husband makes a man a murderer, then Neil would be found guilty of these crimes. But was there legitimate evidence proving that Neil was responsible? Join us today for Cold as Ice, The Murders of Rachel and Lillian Entwistle.
So I've been waiting for a while to do a Massachusetts case because I really wanted to give a review on King Julius, which is one of the best New England IPAs you'll ever drink in your life.
Really?
Really.
Those are big claims.
I know, but it's true. So King Julius is brewed by Treehouse Brewing Company in Charlton, Massachusetts. Beautiful beer. That's the review. No. So it's a dark orange color, great big foamy head, a lot of sticky lace. So visually it's a nice looking beer. Great aroma, a lot of tropical fruit and citrus. Then when you start drinking it, initially you get the citrus fruit up front, some orange, maybe some tangerine. Then the tropical fruit, a lot of pineapple and mango. Wonderful, wonderful beer.
Well, IPAs are really popular, so this would probably appeal to the masses.
This one does, and it's a New England IPA, which means that it's more fruit-forward than hops, so it's not one of those bitter, palate-blasting beers. Very subtle on the hops and very, very fruity. If you like that kind of beer, this is yours.
This is the best one, you said.
This is the best one.
All right, let's open it up. I'm excited to try it.
Okay. So let's hobble on down to the quiet end.
All right, put your crutches up against the wall, and let's get started.
Okay. Neil Entwistle grew up in Worksop, which is about 150 miles from London on the northern edge of the Sherwood Forest. Yes, that Sherwood Forest.
From all the fairy tales.
Well, I don't know. It's a fairy tale. It's Robin Hood.
Oh, aren't there other fairy tales that talk about the Sherwood Forest, though? No? Okay. I thought that Hansel and Gretel were in the Sherwood Forest as well.
No, they were in the Black Forest or something.
All right, my bad.
Hansel and Gretel was written by the Grimm brothers, which are German people.
Yes.
So they take place in Germany.
Okay, well, that makes sense.
The only Sherwood Forest I know is Robin Hood. And Friar Tuck and Little John and all those guys.
Right.
So we digress.
So you can proceed.
Worksop was once a booming town. Men worked in the coal mines and their wives had jobs in ribbon factories. But in the 1970s, the mines were running out of coal and jobs went away. And the women soon were out of work because the ribbon factories became automated and then eventually moved to China. So not much work there, high unemployment rate. The blue-collar jobs remaining were in a plant that made Campbell's soup and bouillon cubes. The poverty that inevitably followed the unemployment brought problems with it, which included teenage pregnancy, prostitution, violence, and drug abuse. Neil and his brother Russell were lucky because they grew up under the watchful eyes of their mother Yvonne and their father Clifford. Clifford still worked in the coal mines and he was a local labor politician. But Neil grew up being ashamed of his upbringing, including his Cockney working-class accent, quite reserved when he talked about his school days, but he actually had a lot to be proud of. In a school where many of the students were illiterate, Neil was an honor student. His grades helped him get accepted to the University of York, where he earned a degree in electronic engineering and business. This was a world way beyond what Neil's family could have imagined for him.
Yeah, they were strictly working-class. He was the first to go to college. And college is where Neil met Rachel. Her name was Rachel Souza. They got together in 1999 on the University of York campus. Rachel was a pretty college exchange student studying English literature. Despite the fact that she was only 5 feet tall, she had been a track star at Silver Lake Regional High School in the Boston suburb of Kingston. It seemed that Rachel was a success at everything that she set her mind to. She was quite a go-getter. She was on her high school's honor roll, and she also did some volunteering as a peer mediator. Rachel was an excellent rower. She was so good that she was invited onto the men's team of York University's boat club. Neil, tall and very shy, was her teammate, and Rachel thought that he was cute. Their romantic connection began as they rowed together. They were facing each other the whole time. And they quickly became a well-known couple on campus. Neil began to introduce Rachel as the woman I'm going to spend my life with. They were super close for over a year when Rachel had to return to the United States to finish her final year at the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Mass. But she was clearly in love with Neil and never showed any interest in other guys after she got back home. So in 2001, she left her family to create a new life in England with Neil. They moved into a small rented cottage, and Rachel began teaching English and drama in September of 2002 at St. Augustine's Catholic High School in the rural town of Redditch. Neil worked for Kinetic, which was a technology company. It was a large laboratory that did military testing on warplanes and aircraft carriers. The company was controversial because of its alliance with the British government, which gave it access to several lucrative contracts. Rachel thought it was the bad press the company got that made Neil act secretive about what he did at his job. He would joke about his job quite a bit, saying that he was like 007, like a secret agent. And Rachel just thought that was charming. Pretty much anything he did in the beginning was just charming.
So Rachel and Neil were married in August of 2003. They had a beautiful ceremony at a church in Menomet, Massachusetts, and the reception was held at the Plymouth Plantation, which was a village built to reenact what it was like to live in the early 1600s. The hall had high ceilings and antique chandeliers. Quite an impressive place.
Yeah, very quaint.
According to her family, Rachel had never been happier than she was on her wedding day. After the wedding, the couple honeymooned on a Mediterranean cruise, and they shared their happiness at being married by making up their own website, rachelandneil.org. So cute.
It is cute.
Rachel was happy, and she wanted people to know how well her life had turned out. She was married to a handsome Englishman. She was going to live in England. Life was everything she could possibly have dreamed it could be.
So that makes this story even more sad, doesn't it?
It does, although I think she was getting away from her delusion.
When she died, they hadn't been married that long. It happened pretty quickly.
I know.
Well, the photos on their website were evidence that she was succeeding in life, and her parents were really thrilled about it. Even though Neil seemed a bit standoffish to them, they were satisfied because he really seemed to make Rachel happy. Working as a high school teacher, Rachel earned the respect and the trust of her students. She taught drama and English, and she would chat and joke with them after class, smiling, and they would tease her about her New England accent. Rachel was also friendly with the other teachers, but they never saw much of Neil, who had this secretive job with a military company. But Rachel definitely seemed to be in love, and she would just smile, light up the room when she talked about her husband. He was everything to her. And she was also anxious to start a family. So less than 2 years after their wedding, she had their baby girl, Lillian Rose Entwistle. And she was born in England in April of 2005. A really cute little baby, although they all are, I guess. But her face looked like Rachel's, and she was just a happy baby. And her parents took hundreds of pictures of her.
Yeah, she's a pretty photogenic kid.
She was cute. So one of Lillian's first photos was taken by a nurse at the hospital, and this was of Neil and Rachel with newborn Lillian swaddled between them in a white blanket. And they posted that picture along with a bunch of other ones on their Rachel and Neil website.
Just a few months after Lillian was born, Neil began complaining to Rachel that his working-class upbringing was going to hold them back from real financial success. Neil was convinced his Cockney accent marked him as a failure, maybe in England. But us people in the U.S. just love any kind of British accent.
Yeah, we don't know any better.
No.
So I think that might have been part of the idea of moving back.
So Neil's insecurity was beginning to hurt their marriage, because for him, the only solution was getting out of England. Rachel thought that was probably a good idea anyway, now that they had a family. She wanted her daughter to be raised as an American, surrounded by her family in Massachusetts, just as she had been. So in September 2005, Neil told his employer that he had to move to the U.S. because of domestic problems.
So there's a red flag that he's kind of a liar right there.
Yeah, because it wasn't anything like that.
No, and not a big deal, but just kind of a little tip off that maybe he's not the most honest guy in the world.
Exactly. So they left their lives in England and moved in with Rachel's parents in their large home in Carver, Massachusetts. When they arrived, Neil confided to Rachel's mom, Priscilla, that Rachel is more family-oriented than he was. And he seemed to feel sorry for himself when life in the United States wasn't any better than life in England had been for him.
Yeah, so maybe the problem went a little bit deeper than just an accent.
Possibly. Although, from the stuff we read about him, he wasn't a real go-getter. I don't think he actively sought jobs. I think he expected jobs to kind of materialize for him, and he could have his choice.
Yeah, that's not a good idea.
No, you got to beat the bushes and work on it.
Yeah, I suppose. Rachel and her mom Priscilla were a lot like girlfriends. Some would say more like girlfriends than mother and daughter. They'd learned to depend on each other after Rachel's father, Paul, had died when Rachel was only 9 years old. So grief had pulled Rachel, her brother Jerome, and their mom into this very tight little family unit. Being home, especially with baby Lily, made this mother-daughter bond even stronger. Rachel was really happy that Priscilla had finally found a new life partner, too. She'd married a divorced dad named Joseph Matarazzo. Her new stepfather looked tough, but he had a very gentle personality, and he was especially calm and caring with baby Lily. They really had some nice pictures of him holding the baby. So both of these grandparents adored this little girl, as most grandparents do.
No question. Yeah. Sure, that's the fun part.
Right.
So Joe was a guy's guy, and Neil was anything but. However, he tried his best to relate with Joe. He went target shooting with Joe once, because Joe was a real firearms enthusiast who had collected several antique and rare guns. Neil's choice of weapons was a .22 caliber, which is pretty much a small handgun. After a day of firing at paper targets, Neil watched as Joe returned the guns to a lockbox in his master bedroom and put the keys on the kitchen countertop. Joe didn't notice if Neil was following as he went about the routine of putting away his guns and stashing his keys. If he had, he probably would have thought nothing of it.
Sure.
A little foreshadowing here.
Yeah. Now, the extended family spent Christmas of 2005 together. The town of Carver is just a beautiful place around the holidays, decorated with white lights, and the trees are all decorated. There were red ribbons wrapped around pine tree wreaths that hung on the front doors of most of the houses, too. So Neil was really impressed with Christmas in New England. Up until then, the holidays for him had been spent in a town where many people celebrated Christmas just hanging out in the local bar. The big event was this annual holiday pub quiz. So not a big family Christmas, normally.
Mm-hmm. Far from it.
Of course, they're just getting by. His family was. So in one family picture, Neil held baby Lily up to the top branches of the family's Christmas tree to place her first ornament. In another, Neil lay on the floor with Lillian on his chest. And she had this big smile, looking at her mom as Rachel snapped a picture. And Rachel posted that picture on their website with the caption, "I love my daddy." This is something that people would look back on just with enormous sadness and confusion about what happened. So as far as Priscilla and Joseph were concerned, Rachel and her family could stay with them in the Carver house forever. Priscilla really loved having her daughter and granddaughter there. But Neil, understandably, I'd say, wanted to move his family into their own home. It was kind of stifling to live with his wife's parents, he said, especially when he was having a hard time finding a job, so he was around the house a lot. He had gone to several interviews, but none of the computer companies had showed any interest in hiring him. But he acted as if money wasn't an issue at all. He told his in-laws that he was earning $10,000 a month from the English military to advise them on secretive computer programs. So even if he didn't get another job, that was definitely enough money for him to provide for Rachel and Lillian.
Sure.
So the parents weren't worried.
Not at that point.
Even if they went out for dinner as a family, the whole group of them, Neil would always pull out a credit card and give it to the wait person before anyone else could pay. He wouldn't let anyone else pay, so I think he wanted to look like the big spender.
Oh, of course.
The Entwistles were living on credit, though, so really, he did not have the money. Rachel would explain their lack of cash by saying that Neil's money was tied up in offshore accounts. Those complications would make the purchase of a home impossible for them. But then they started looking at expensive rental houses in the communities surrounding Carver. And this is when Priscilla became a little worried about Neil's story. She had her guard set up slightly, especially after he gave her a business card, supposedly for his own high-tech startup company. And this card was just a folded piece of paper held together with cellophane tape, and it read ENT Embedded New Technologies. So this didn't look like a real business card at all. It looked like something he printed off the computer and put tape on.
Exactly.
And it doesn't take much money to order business cards.
No, it doesn't.
No. But still, I guess Priscilla respected their privacy. That's the way that she had been raised, and the way she'd raised Rachel, is that everybody's allowed their own privacy, especially in financial matters. You know, these are New England values. And in New England, you don't talk about money.
No, you don't.
Mm-mm. And you'll talk about sex before money.
Yeah, but that's still pretty far down the list also.
Yeah, true. Now, she had no reason to suspect Neil of anything. And Neil and Rachel's finances, to her, were none of her business. But if she'd done any research on Neil's business, she would have found out that the company's address was on Tremont Street in Carver, the location of Priscilla and Joe's home.
Besides this, though, his in-laws otherwise had no worries about his dedication to his family. Priscilla noticed that Neil looked at Rachel with complete admiration. At Lily's christening, Neil smiled proudly as he took photos of Rachel holding Lillian after she was baptized. It was shortly after the christening that Neil and Rachel announced that they were going to move into a rented house in nearby Hopkinton. Priscilla was secretly disappointed, but she did take comfort in knowing that the new house was close enough so that it could still be part of their daily lives.
Well, and Rachel and her mom did speak every day.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
They were very close, as you said.
They were, and the baby seemed to even make them closer. On January 14th, 2006, Neil, Rachel, and baby Lillian moved into a nice four-bedroom colonial home at 6 Cubs Path in Hopkinton. The house was listed for sale for $549,000, and Neil managed to convince the owner into giving them a short-term lease for $2,700 a month, telling her that once his offshore accounts were moved to the United States in 12 weeks, they would purchase the house. That is a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you're making over $100,000 a year, $2,700 is a hell of a mortgage.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, the line he gave the owner was, as soon as my money comes in, you know, I put down a large chunk of cash, if not all of it, and buy the house.
Exactly. So he was a real bullshitter.
Yeah.
The Entwistles gave the landlord a certified check for $5,400. And that paid for first and last month's rent, along with another payment of $2,700 for January. For Rachel, this was a dream house in the perfect neighborhood. The 2,400-square-foot home was on a quiet cul-de-sac, so when Lillian got older, she could play on the front lawn without her parents worrying about traffic. The house was on a block of just 8 brand-new high-end homes, and their neighbors were mostly families, professional people, with good incomes. And the house was beautiful inside. It had brand new cabinets, ceramic tile floors, and it had a little built-in desk in the kitchen where Neil would work alongside his family as Rachel made dinner or fed Lily. The house also had high cathedral ceilings, a large fireplace, and it had a nice back patio with a hot tub. So it's a hell of a starter home.
Yeah, I was thinking, this is a starter home?
I know.
Oh, well.
Well, I mean, a lot of people do this and they go into debt. But, you know, if you have a good job, it's doable. I know you're very frugal and it wouldn't be your choice. But
no,
people do this.
It wouldn't be.
And if he'd had a decent job, it probably could have been managed. But we know that he didn't. So,
well, he had no job.
Really overextending everything.
Yeah.
And I think after they moved in, it didn't take long for Rachel to kind of see what was going on here and that they were in trouble financially.
Things came crashing down pretty quickly. But he had done kind of his own pyramid scheme. Neil had.
Right.
And once things started falling apart, they will go fast.
Yeah. And he wasn't very good at it.
No, he wasn't.
No.
So they didn't have furniture to fill the house. So Neil went to an upscale furniture store and spent more than $3,000 on a living room set. He then bought a crib and a bed for another $3,000. These are, of course, all on credit.
Yeah.
Hopkinton, one of those quaint New England towns, has about 5,000 families living there. The town's main street had twinkling Christmas lights during its Winter Wonderland Festival, and there were ice cream socials and costume parades in the summer. A white gazebo in the town center was decorated for each holiday. Serious crime is almost unheard of in a place like Hopkinton.
Yeah, so this should have been Rachel's dream come true. She went to college, she got a good job, she married the perfect guy, she had a baby. So it should have all been coming together for her, but it was actually falling apart. So it's really sad to think about what she was going through. So let's take a short break here to talk about our sponsors.
Okay. This episode is sponsored by ADT. ADT can design and install a smart home just for you, backed by 24/7 protection. And there are a vast number of things you can do with your own secure smart home. ADT has Doorman Service, which is ADT automation that can unlock doors for package deliveries, friends, or kids who forget their keys. They also have a cool service called Turndown Service. This is an ADT automation that arms your security system, locks your doors, and even turns down your lights and thermostat. They think of everything, pretty much.
Oh, they absolutely do. So now you can listen to true crime podcasts or watch Oxygen or the ID channel, feeling secure.
That's it. So ADT even offers worry-free getaway service, which lets you arm your system, lock up and set lighting schedules before you go on vacation. And this is all controlled from the ADT app, or the sound of your voice, and backed by ADT's 24/7 protection. Best of all, with ADT, you don't have to worry about installing and configuring your system. ADT will do it for you. DIFY, as the hipsters say. If this sounds good to you, just visit ADT.com/smart to learn more about how ADT can design and install a secure smart home just for you.
Well, I have an exciting announcement to make on behalf of Payne Lindsay and Oxygen. In a one-night special TV event, Oxygen brings to life Payne Lindsay's hit true crime podcast, Up and Vanished. In 2016, Payne took a deep dive into the disappearance of Tara Grinstead, a young teacher who went missing 13 years ago. Payne has dedicated himself to Tara's case every day, slowly unlocking the secrets that her small town could not shake. Tara was last seen on October 21st, 2005 in Ascilla, Georgia. She was heading home from a barbecue and suddenly disappeared. Tara's story remained a mystery for over a decade. Then Payne stepped in. His search for the truth got the town to start talking. And the Up and Vanished podcast became a national phenomenon, reaching over 240 million people. But the story doesn't end there, because Payne is still at work, determined to find answers. Don't miss Up and Vanished, a one-night special TV event based on the hit podcast, Sunday, November 18th at 7 on Oxygen, the new network for crime.
So back to the story. Usually the most serious crimes for the Hopkinton Police Department is a drunk husband hitting his wife or a drunk driver hitting a parked car, kids smashing pumpkins on porches on Halloween night or toilet papering trees was a big deal there. In 2006, the police department's chief managed 4 sergeants, 2 detectives, and 14 patrol cops. Still, they were a professional group, and each of them was highly trained.
Yeah, so just because this was a small area, these weren't Barney Fifes. These people did know what they were doing.
Well, they did. Plus, remember, it's only 20-some miles from Boston. It's where we start the Boston Marathon. So, 26 miles.
Right, yep.
So it's close to the big city.
It is. But it was also the perfect setting for raising a family, which is why Neil and Rachel were so excited that they were raising their little Lillian there. Rachel was busy decorating her new dream house, emptying boxes, unpacking dishes, organizing cabinets. She had slacked off on updating her family's website. So the last post she made was days after Christmas 2005, and it read, "The three of us are doing well. The baptism was wonderful, and Lily looked perfect." After the movers left on January 16, 2006, there was tension in the Entwistle home. Neil refused to answer any of Rachel's questions about their finances, and they were having daily arguments. Rachel, of course, was exhausted. Just that week, she told her mother that she'd tried to use one of Neil's credit cards, but the account had been frozen. So this was alarming.
Yeah, so things are starting to fall apart. His carefully constructed story about the $10,000 a month he's receiving from the British government is clearly not true.
Right.
Because we're getting credit cards refused.
Yeah, the whole offshore account thing was complete fiction.
Right.
Well, money problems were the last thing Rachel needed after they'd just moved into this expensive new home, and they have a baby. She was also really worried about paying off the $18,000 remaining on her student loans. The holidays, followed by the move just months after leaving England, and the responsibility of caring for a baby and working, was really draining for her, as you can imagine. So it was early that night when Rachel decided to go to bed. Neil stayed downstairs using the laptop, which he had bought on credit. So, knowing what we know now, he probably listened until Rachel was in bed before he brought up an internet search engine and typed in a series of words that investigators would find later. How to kill yourself. Suicide. How to kill someone with a knife. Euthanasia. The answers to his searches were very gruesome. One site described ways to murder and cautioned that stabbing someone to death can take longer than you might think. So if Rachel had any idea what he was looking up, she probably would have gotten out of there.
I would think. The other thing that he did after he did his searches was starting to look for sex online. He started the search at Adult Friend Finder, where he wrote, "I am in a current relationship, but looking for a bit more fun in the bedroom, and a very discreet relationship just for fun." He even posted a full-length picture of himself leaning back in a lawn chair. This photo is probably taken in the backyard of his in-laws' home, and in it, he's holding his genitals in his hand, and his penis was erect. So he's ready.
Ready to go.
Yep.
He's on the market, which he shouldn't be.
He exchanged a few provocative emails with one woman online, apparently didn't lead to anything, and then he went to bed.
Well, it could have led to something, like online sex.
Oh,
it
okay.
Didn't lead to anything in person.
No, he stayed at home.
So the next day, Rachel continued to unpack. Lily was irritable and crying that day, and Rachel was looking forward to Saturday night when her friend from college, Joanna Gately, and her sister Maureen were coming to dinner. Now, Joanna and Rachel had graduated from Holy Cross together in 2001, and Rachel wanted things at the house to be in place before her visit. But the house was still a mess. Rachel was too tired to deal with it that night and went to bed early again. That night as Rachel slept, Neil went on his laptop again and repeated the creepy internet search, typing in words like murder, suicide by knife, and killing someone. That search went on for more than an hour. Then he began searching for escort services in Boston and Worcester. What came up first was the Eros Guide in Boston, which gave him a list of women for every man's preference, blonde, brunette, redhead, along with categories for various fetishes. The one that Neil clicked on was Blonde Beauty's Escort Service, and that site came with a Yahoo map of its location in Worcester, which was about 25, 30 miles from Hopkinton. He could be there in about half an hour. He then contacted some of the escort services that he had searched the night before, and he actually printed out some maps. We know all of this about his internet activities from the examination of his computer hard drive. It's unclear, however, what Neil did for the rest of that night of January 17th. He may have gone out, or he may have just gone to bed. Rachel slept through the night, and so did baby Lillian.
Yeah, then the next morning, Rachel cautiously asked Neil about any leads he had on getting a job. Even though Neil had told her that their finances were fine, Rachel knew something was wrong, and Neil was acting very strangely. He told her about an interview he had scheduled for the next afternoon at an electronic design company. He said he was sure that he would find a job. And also the money the British government had been depositing into his offshore accounts would be freed up soon.
So he's continuing with that charade, even though I would think at this point Rachel knows it's not real.
She knows something bad is wrong, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, in reality, we know now that Neil was really beginning to panic. His credit cards were being cut off one by one. Rachel probably had no idea how much trouble they were really in. The fact that they were broke was his secret, but he wasn't going to be able to hide this from her forever. Neil had begun to invest in get-rich schemes that advertised on the internet. He'd bought into one scam called Huge Millionaire Moneymaker, but hadn't made any money with that. His schemes actually had started back in 2002 when he and Rachel were still living in the United Kingdom. He targeted people like himself looking to make easy money with very little work. And one of his promises told people to send him just 2,000 English pounds, and that would buy them a startup kit that assisted subscribers in creating an online pornography business with websites that could earn 2 million pounds a year. He called this scam Million Maker, and he spammed it out to people with the subject line, "Make serious money, make serious money, make serious money." Now, we've all gotten these kind of spam emails, and most of us delete them immediately.
Or don't even open them.
Right, exactly.
And by 2004, Neil had an epiphany, and he moved on to hardcore porno sites on his own. One was deephotsex.com. Another was bigpenismanual.com. These sites were registered under the name Mark Smith, but a search of the URLs came back to Neil Entwistle. The first website offered paid access to online videos of, quote, barely legal, end of quote, teen girls performing sex acts. He also ran a scheme selling pirated copies of spamming computer software programs. But by 2006, all these schemes were falling apart. His sales on eBay were scams, and he ended up with a very poor rating. And then, in early 2006, complaints about his products were started to show up. Some of the software was being sold under the name Neil Entwistle, but some under the name Rachel. And we have no evidence that Rachel was involved in any of this.
No, but she probably did find out about some of it.
Yeah.
So even if there was this suspicion in Rachel's mind about her husband, she may have been willing to ignore it to maintain her image of the life she wanted. It was important to her. Over the holidays and then in January, Neil's email account began to fill up with angry customers demanding their cash back. On January 21st, Rachel's friend Joanna and her sister Maureen were 2 hours late for their planned dinner at Rachel's house. All of the lights were on inside, and they could see the expensive new furniture in the living room. The table was set as if people were coming to dinner. There were dishes on the table, so it looked like the Entwistles were expecting them. Joanna began knocking loudly, and then she called Rachel's cell phone, and she heard Rachel's cell phone ring inside the house. Now, no one goes anywhere without their cell phone, and Rachel had apparently left hers at home. Joanna didn't think so. She thought that Rachel had to be there, and she became really concerned.
Well, she ought to be.
Yes.
Although you could also say that the Entwistles were home and they were pissed off because these folks were 2 hours late and they just weren't going to answer the door.
Right. That's not likely.
No.
But after about 30 minutes of standing at the door, Joanna became more and more anxious. She did know that something was wrong because Rachel kept in touch and was not the kind of person to just not talk to her. She became more concerned when she saw the note that Rachel's mom had left in the mailbox. "Where are you?" it said. "Call me, Mom." So Joanna called Rachel's mother and found Priscilla pretty much in a frantic state. She had been trying to reach Rachel for 2 days, and they spoke every day, so this was very unusual. And she knew that Rachel had been looking forward to that dinner on Saturday night all week, so she wouldn't just not be there. So both of the women, Joanna and Priscilla, agreed it was totally out of character for Rachel not to return phone calls or to back out of plans without telling anyone. Rachel's cell phone, still being on the kitchen counter, made them even more worried and uneasy. So about 8:30 p.m., Joanna just gave up waiting and drove to the Hopkinton police station. Now, she knew that it was going to sound kind of crazy to be reporting an entire family missing just because of broken dinner plans. And the report probably would have been ignored at a busier police station, especially if they'd been in downtown Boston, but it was a slow night in Hopkinton. Also, carbon monoxide deaths are really not uncommon there in the colder months. The gas could have seeped into the young couple's new and unfamiliar home. Remember, they'd only been there a little over a week. Just 5 months earlier, 7 people in nearby Duxbury were overcome by carbon monoxide and nearly died before they were rushed to the hospital. In that case, they all survived, but the incident was on the minds of police officers in every town nearby.
So the police dispatcher, Sergeant Charles Wallace, transmitted a call to patrol car officers Michael Sutton and Aaron O'Neill, and he asked them to report to 6 Cubs Path to do a well-being check. Joanna had not been the only one to ask. By the time she turned up at the police station, Priscilla had already called and spoken to Sergeant Wallace about her concerns for her daughter. So Joanna and her sister met the patrolman in the Entwistle's driveway. Both cops walked the perimeter of the house, found all the windows and doors locked. There were lights on. The TV was in the living room, and they could hear a dog barking. So it looked as if the home was occupied.
Well, yeah, the TV was actually running. It was on.
So Sergeant Sutton pulled a laminated Blockbuster video store card out of his wallet and jimmied it back and forth in the bottom lock of the front door. And after a few minutes, he heard a snap and pushed the door open. So the officers walked into a foyer, then into the kitchen and dining room. In a room off the kitchen, they found the Entwistle's Basset Hound in a crate. So an officer O'Neill searched the basement as Sutton went to the second floor. He heard classical music coming from a radio in Lillian's room, but the crib was empty.
Yeah, there was no sign of a break-in. Sutton noted that the table was laid out as if the family was getting ready for dinner, and there were dirty dishes in the sink. An upstairs bathtub was still filled with water. Both cops climbed the stairs and noticed that the bedclothes in the master bedroom were in disarray, as if the bed had been slept in and was unmade. But they only looked in from the doorway. The Entwistles only had one car and there was no vehicle in the garage. Sutton ran the plate number through his cruiser's registry of motor vehicle system to make sure that no one had run a be on the lookout or found the car abandoned. There was no report of a crash involving the vehicle, and it had not been found abandoned. So this all seems like good news. It seemed like the Entwistles had just left for the night and not told their friends that dinner was canceled. So Sutton made sure everything was secure inside, and he walked out to let Joanna know that they hadn't found anything. Joanna at this time was on her cell phone talking to Rachel's mom, Priscilla, and she handed the phone to the officer so he could tell Rachel's mother what he had found. He did allow Joanna to go and take the dog for a walk before he relocked the house, and then they put the dog back in her crate. He checked again to see that everything was locked up and pulled the door shut for the last time that night, but Joanna was not satisfied. Joanna and Maureen parked their car in front of the Entwistle's house, and they just settled in. They were more worried than ever, and there was no way that they were leaving the house until they knew that Rachel and the baby were safe.
The next morning was January 22nd, and Joanna walked back into the police station. She looked pale and disheveled, and Rachel's parents were with her. Joe Matarazzo had called his old neighbor and friend Joe Flaherty, who had been an investigator with the state police, and Flaherty's specialty had been homicide. He had retired just a couple years earlier, but his name commanded respect from his former law enforcement professionals. So his friend Joe made the call to him after Priscilla told him that Hopkinton police had said there would not be a detective available to really investigate a missing persons case until Monday afternoon. That was Sunday. And they've already been missing her for a couple days, right?
Yes, yep.
So Priscilla had last spoken to Rachel on Thursday night. Something was wrong, and the family would not wait another 24 hours for the Hopkinton police to help them.
No, because they knew that this wasn't just a fluke.
Yeah, so Flaherty made a call to police and asked if they could call in a detective on his day off so that an investigator could take the job from start to finish. Because ordinarily, a patrol officer would make the report and then wait for a detective to respond. After Flattery's call, Hopkinton police began to act with more of a sense of urgency. It became clear that the well-being check they had done the night before was not just a routine case of a broken dinner engagement. So Detective Scott Van Ralton came in on his day off to work the case. This guy Flaherty must have some pull.
Sounds like it, doesn't it?
Joanna gave the police the garage code she had gotten from the neighbor. She looked pretty nervous. She didn't want to mention it with Rachel's parents nearby, but when she'd gone into the house to walk the dog again, she'd been hit by a foul odor that wasn't coming from the dog. The stench was overwhelming, one that she had never smelled before. She didn't need to be a scientist to detect that the rancid odor was a sign that something very bad had happened inside the house.
So how alarming would that be? So upsetting.
Wouldn't it? Because you know what's behind the odor.
You have a pretty good idea that something happened to somebody, and you're missing your friend and her little baby.
Mm-hmm.
When police entered the house again, of course they noticed the smell. It was completely overwhelming, and it was strongest outside of the master bedroom, which, remember, the night before they'd only looked at from the doorway. So the bed appeared to be in the same condition as it was in the day before during their first walkthrough. But this time they did notice a lady's wristwatch and a pair of eyeglasses on the floor next to the bed. So now they're just filled with this feeling of dread, of course. It was Sergeant Sutton that went up there first, and he pulled back the comforter, knowing he was going to find something awful, and he saw a woman's foot near the foot of the bed. And then he saw the face of a baby, and this baby had been dead for some time. He assumed that it was the smiling 9-month-old who'd been reported missing, Lillian, and he'd seen this little baby's pictures all over the house, a smiling, happy, healthy little girl. But he couldn't be sure it was her because her face was battered and unrecognizable. So somebody had hurt her. Killed her, of course, but hurt her face as well, as if there'd been some kind of a beating. Rachel was dead also, and she was lying in the fetal position with Lillian clutched to her chest. Lillian was lying on her back, cradled next to her mother. But the manner of death was not immediately known. Only when the state medical examiner arrived to move the bodies and Lillian was pulled from Rachel, did the police see that Lillian had been shot in her stomach, and that bullet had passed through her and hit Rachel in her torso. But there was also a small hole in the center of Rachel's forehead, just above her hairline. In addition to the baby's gunshot wound, something had happened to her face, as if she'd been hit, punched in the face. There were bruises around her left eye, her nose and her mouth, along with blood and mucus crusted on her nostrils and lips. So this is a horrific find.
Isn't it? So the piece of shit who killed him.
Yeah.
Beat her.
Hit a baby.
Yeah.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
Neil Entwistle was not found in the house, and this led to a search for him and the Entwistle's car.
Early on, Middlesex DA Martha Coakley spoke to the public.
Yesterday afternoon, approximately 6:30 or so, on what was a fairly routine well-being check, at 6 Cubs Path in Hopkinton, the Hopkinton police went to check on Rachel Entwistle, age 27, her husband Neil Entwistle, also age 27, and their 9-month-old daughter, Lillian Entwistle. When police did enter, they discovered upstairs on a bed the bodies of Rachel Entwistle and her daughter. At that time, there was no obvious signs of foul play. Ironically, police believed they were deceased, but did not see any signs of violence or what the cause of death would be. We have been in the process of locating Neil Entwistle, who authorities believe is traveling.
Do you know where he may be?
We have some ideas where he may be.
It took just 45 minutes for the state troopers to locate the vehicle in one of the parking lots at Logan Airport. It had been parked in the garage since 10:49 p.m. on Saturday night, which was just hours after Joanna had showed up at the Entwistle home. Airport security cameras had captured Neil pulling into the garage at 8:14 p.m., but he left for some reason at 9:34. Investigators would later learn that he had driven to several automatic teller machines where he tried to get cash advances from a number of different credit cards. Then he had purchased a small amount of gas, enough to get him back to the airport. He pulled back in at 10:49. When state troopers found the vehicle, the doors were locked and keys were in the ignition. Neil Entwistle had used a Visa debit card to buy a one-way ticket to London for the 2:38 p.m. flight that left Boston Sunday afternoon. But a seat had opened up on an earlier flight, so at 8:15 in the morning, Neil Entwistle had boarded a British Airways flight to London.
There are a lot of ways you could say that people react to a tragedy. People can be kind of in shock and not show much emotion. People can be in a panic, totally freaked out. But fleeing is definitely a sign of guilt. You don't just flee a scene and not try and get help.
This is a new one, right?
So this looks really bad.
I mean, he just took off. He didn't talk to anybody.
No.
And his parents didn't even know he was arriving home until he got home.
Well, more significant to me is no emergency services were called. Nothing.
Nothing.
And even if he hadn't been at home, why is he leaving the country all of a sudden? It's all pointing in his direction as the guilty party right away. Of course, Priscilla and Joe were devastated when they heard that Rachel and Lillian had been found dead in their home. This is like worst-case scenario nightmare. The only thing keeping both of them going during the days after was the work that they were doing, helping investigators find the killer and try and find a motive for the crime. Priscilla gave detectives statements from Rachel's bank accounts and pointed to the $18,000 in student loan debt. She handed over the fake business card Neil had given to her just a few weeks before. Then she remembered that Neil had used her computer at her home on January 16th, the last time that he and Rachel had been there, and she gave police permission to search it. A Palm Pilot, which those were like little computers?
Yeah.
Yeah, before cell phones were around, really. Or were around to the point where they were computers and you went on the internet and all that. You just made calls with them. So a Palm Pilot was found at the Six Cubs Path house, and that was also entered into evidence, along with two laptop computers and a bunch of data storage disks. They couldn't be positive that Neil was the murderer, although of course as time passed, Neil was looking more and more like the prime suspect. Even with the small chance that he was innocent, leaving the country just seemed like a very cold thing to do, as well as odd.
Yes. So on January 23rd, investigators contacted Neil at his parents' home in Worksop. He told police that he found the bodies of his wife and baby dead at around 11 o'clock in the morning on the 20th, and he had no idea who had killed them. We talked to the trooper for about 2 hours. Now, if you're interested in this, the entire conversation is available to listen to on YouTube. So Neil says to the detective on the phone, "Sir, I woke up on Friday, fed Lily, and left the house a couple hours later to do some errands. I went to Staples, headed to Walmart, but never made it, then came back to the house around 11 a.m. He couldn't explain why he'd never made it to Walmart or how he'd spent the 2 hours he claimed to be away from the home that morning. I left the garage door up, so I came in through the garage to the basement door. I went upstairs and checked the baby's room. She wasn't in there. I didn't hear her crying, and I couldn't find Rachel. I went into my bedroom and saw Rachel. She had a comforter over her. I pulled it back, and there was Rachel, pale, real pale. There was blood on the baby. The baby had been shot. They were dead," Neil said as he began to cry. "I pulled the covers back over them and left the room," Neil said. He described to the trooper how he'd run downstairs and grabbed a knife from the kitchen to kill himself, but he ended up putting it down because it would hurt too much.
Yeah, how do you feel about that statement? It's really kind of sickening, isn't it?
Beyond sickening. Neil told the trooper that he'd then driven to Carver to tell his in-laws what had happened. He claimed that he didn't have Priscilla and Joe's phone number. Later, he said that he'd gone to their house to get a gun to shoot himself with. But no one was there and he couldn't get into the house. So he's going to go to Priscilla's job, but he couldn't remember how to get there. Then he drove to the airport and walked around a bit, left, drove back to Hopkinton, but ended up buying gas and went back to the airport. He said he wanted to go home to be with his parents.
Does it make any sense?
It makes absolutely no sense.
Well, on January 24th, the Tuesday after the bodies were found, Middlesex District Attorney Martha Coakley's office sent out a press release about their findings. The Office of the Chief Medical Examiner has completed its autopsies on the bodies of a 27-year-old woman and her 9-month-old daughter, who were found dead in their Hopkinton home Sunday evening. While initially investigators only detected one gunshot wound to Rachel Entwistle's torso, autopsy revealed that the cause of death was a gunshot wound to the head. the ME found the cause of death of 9-month-old Lillian Entwistle to be a single gunshot wound to the abdomen. So both deaths were ruled homicides. There was no mention of the bruises, though, that covered Lillian's tiny face, or of the fact that the bodies were missed the first time Hopkinton police had conducted their well-being search. That's a bit of an embarrassment.
Yeah, it is, but, you know, at the time they did it, there was not a huge suspicion.
No.
Yes, it was a cursory search, but I can't fault them terribly.
Well, and it was too late to help at that point anyway.
Yeah.
Well, as hard as Coakley tried to keep it quiet, by the time her office released that statement, it had already been leaked that Neil was in England. Both the Boston Herald and the Boston Globe had dispatched reporters to his hometown to try and find him. Also, producers from television news outlets were filling up the flights to London. So big story, of course.
Very big. So police identified Neil as a person of interest in the investigation before later that day, and they issued an international arrest warrant. After he was traced to London on February 9, 2006, Neil was arrested on a tube train at Royal Oak Station, following in-depth searches of his parents' house. He initially requested that he not be sent back to the United States, but then did later agree to be extradited.
The autopsy results were that Rachel had been shot in the forehead, just above the hairline above her forehead. Lillian had died from a gunshot wound to the abdomen that actually passed through her body and entered Rachel's torso. Also, Rachel had died instantly from the shot to the head, but the bullet that moved through the baby's stomach would work more slowly, so infant Lillian had probably suffered quite a bit. The entry wounds were so small, though, that Neil's claim that he had seen his wife and baby had been shot when he lifted the covers off the bed seemed impossible, because even Sergeant Sutton, who discovered the bodies, hadn't been sure how they died until the medical examiner actually lifted Lillian away from Rachel. Investigators got a warrant to take a sample of Neil's DNA from a water bottle that they found in the cup holder of the car. They compared it to DNA found on the grip of a .22 that Neil had taken from Joe Matarazzo's gun collection. Of course, Joe's DNA was also found on the gun because he had actually used it, not knowing what had happened, the day after the murder. The conclusion eventually provided the basis for the murder case against Neil. The DNA on the grip matched his own. The statistical probability of the DNA match not being Neil's is 1 in 5,299 trillion. Investigators concluded that he'd shot Rachel at such close range that there was a blowback of blood and brain matter on the weapon itself, as forensic scientists would discover when studying the DNA that was recovered from the gun. Rachel's DNA on the muzzle of her stepfather's .22 proved that it was the weapon used because she had never touched this gun before. Although later on he would try and claim that she had killed herself, and just to save her honor, he had taken the gun back.
Best he could come up with, huh?
Yeah, but his parents actually made an announcement about that after the trial.
Well, they believe in their son.
Yeah.
So on March 28th, Neil was indicted on 2 counts of murder, the illegal possession of a firearm, and the illegal possession of ammunition.
Yeah, that's after he was flown to the United States on February 15th.
And he was held without bail. So that April, he pled not guilty to all charges and was ordered to be held again without bail. Over the following months, his defense team argued to have the case dismissed, but they were unsuccessful. They worked very hard. They had issues with the search because they claimed that Entwistle had not given permission for them to search his home so that all the evidence that they gathered from searching his home should be dismissed. And they also had, this is the time when there was a big to-do over DNA testing in the state lab in Massachusetts.
What kind of a to-do?
Well, there was a huge backlog, reports of poor work. A lot of cases got dismissed because of lack of verifiable DNA testing.
I would just say in this case, you don't even need the DNA.
No.
I mean, just circumstantially, he seems guilty beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, so, but his lawyer wanted both these objections.
Sure.
Neither of which were upheld.
But it made the trial get postponed quite a bit.
It was a while.
Yeah. In December 2006, it was nearly a year after Rachel and Lillian had been killed, that officers at the jail where Neil was being held found letters to his parents and to his legal team, which indicated that he was depressed and may have been contemplating suicide. And after that, he was transferred to the Bridgewater State Hospital and evaluated, but he was cleared and returned to the jail. After several delays, it was in June 2008 when the juror selection process began for Neil's trial. Some media reported that potential jurors were saying that they already had formed opinions on his guilt.
Neil was found guilty on all charges on June 25, 2008, and he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole that next day. The formal legal arguments in the trial had ended on June 23rd. After deliberating for 9 hours over 2 days, the jury had found Neil guilty of first-degree murder. He was also found guilty of the illegal possession of a firearm and ammunition. Again, he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole, and this was the mandatory sentence for someone convicted of first-degree murder in the state of Massachusetts. The judge imposed 2 concurrent life sentences. In the days after sentencing, the verdict went to automatic appeal in the High Court. What has happened since 2008 is that all appeals have been denied. The Supreme Court of the United States has refused to hear the case. So at this point, it looks like Entwistle has no appeals left.
Yeah, in October 2008, Neil's parents filed a complaint of harassment against their local newspaper, the Worksop Guardian. The complaint was rejected. Neil's parents continue to insist that their son is innocent of the murders, claiming that Rachel was the true killer, and that he will eventually be cleared and released from prison. Neil's mother told reporters, "The evidence points to Rachel murdering our grandchild and then committing suicide." Now, of course, this is especially hurtful to Rachel's family. So unless they have a real reason to believe this, they really shouldn't be saying that. I understand it's their son, but come on. That's an awful thing to say. Not only were Rachel and her baby murdered, but then Rachel's memory is just tainted with these claims that she killed her baby.
It's insult to injury, doesn't it?
There's no indication that she would have done that.
No.
No. So there's one interesting tidbit from prison. In August of 2008, Neil was tricked into shaving his head in an attempt to secure the protection of a white supremacist prison gang. But instead of giving him protection, the gang had reportedly said, "It's a nice gesture on your part, but we're going to kill you anyway." So after that, Neil was put into protective custody inside the prison. And that December, he was transferred to the medium security prison, Old Colony Correctional Center in Bridgewater, Massachusetts. So do you have any doubts in your mind that Neil did this?
No, none. Even if you tried to invoke the mother doing it. That means she cradled the baby next to her, shot the baby through the stomach, and it entered her body. So I don't think she was going to try to do that.
Right. We're forgetting that the baby's face was injured as well.
Right.
And it takes a real sick fucker to do that.
And there is no gun found on the premises. So how do you kill yourself and the weapon disappears?
Well, I think Neil's claim was that he found them and took the gun back to his stepfather or his father-in-law's house to protect Rachel's memory.
And he knew that that gun had come from his father-in-law's house.
I guess.
Okay.
He had used it.
All right. It's just too far-fetched to even begin to believe.
Yeah. We're going to throw that out. So more on this case. What would we recommend? I know there's a book called Heartless, The True Story of Neil Entwistle and the Cold-Blooded Murder of His Wife and Child that was written by Michelle McPhee. And there are some documentaries as well, right?
Yeah, we watched, I forget whose network it was on, but we saw a couple.
Yeah, pretty well-known case. I mean, if you go on YouTube, you'll find a lot about it.
It is, and this was a big deal when we were living in New England.
Yeah, but it seems pretty open and shut. I don't really have any questions about what happened too much.
No, it's not a mystery.
No.
I don't think.
I don't either. The music for True Crime Brewery is written and produced by Tristan Capel. Please send us your comments and case suggestions for our feedback feature that we have at the end of each episode. If you go to tygrabber.com and leave us a voicemail, and if we play it on an episode, we will send you a free True Crime Brewery t-shirt. To offer support to True Crime Brewery and get access to our members-only, ad-free episodes, please go to our website, tygrabber.com, and subscribe. For a small monthly contribution, you'll receive a package of cool TCB gifts, all access to True Crime Brewery Premium, which is our members-only show, and we're probably going to be pretty fond of you for the rest of our days.
We will.
Yeah.
You'll have our undying gratitude.
There'll be a spot in our hearts for you.
This episode of True Crime Brewery has been sponsored by ADT. ADT can design and install a smart home just for you, backed by 24/7 protection. This can include doorman service, which is an ADT automation that unlocks the door for package deliveries, friends, or your kids. Turn down service that arms your system, locks your doors, and turns down your lights and thermostat at bedtime. This is all controlled from the ADT app or by the sound of your voice. Just visit ADT.com/smart to learn more about how ADT can design and install a secure smart home just for you.
Okay, now let's do feedback.
Okay, we got 4 voice messages to begin with.
Woohoo!
Yeah. So the first one is from Ryan, and it's a case suggestion.
All right, let's hear what Ryan had to say.
Hey guys, it's Ryan from Ontario, Canada. Just calling to say that you guys are one of my favorite true crime podcasts out there, and that you guys are the cutest couple I've ever heard. Now, I sent a suggestion about a couple months ago, and I never ended up hearing it on the show. And I just wanted to say thank you. And my suggestion was Bruce MacArthur from Toronto, Ontario, Canada, who killed numerous men in and around the GTA, going into gay clubs. And he owned a business, a landscaping business, where he would cut up the bodies, place them in the pots and in the dirt, and he'd continue on with his day. He was just uncovered early this year, and I would like to hear your rendition on this creepy old man. Thanks, guys. And one more thing. I didn't just call for the T-shirt contest. I did end up sending one a while back. I just don't know what happened to it. So hope you guys have a good one, and thanks so much for everything you do. You guys are great. Take care.
Thanks, Ryan.
Yes, thank you.
So I do remember getting a voicemail from you, Ryan, a while back, and something was wrong with the audio, so I wasn't able to play it. So I'm glad that you called back.
Good that you persevered.
Yes, so this, you're going to send me an email with your address and your shirt size.
That's all we need.
Okay.
So this is an interesting thing. This is about men disappearing between 2010 and 2017, and there's a task force created to link the disappearance of 3 men of South Asian or Middle Eastern origin, called Project Houston. Now, they didn't achieve much success in this task force. And then fast forward to 2017, there is more and more public speculation of a serial killer, and there was evidence gained from another missing persons investigation, which led the Toronto Police Service to create a second divisional task force, this one called Project PRISM. And this was a little more successful. In January of this year, Project PRISM investigators obtained evidence connecting 2 disappearances to Bruce MacArthur, who was a 66-year-old landscaper. They arrested Mr. MacArthur on January 18th, 2018.
Okay. So has he gone to trial yet?
I'll have to look at some more. I don't think he's been tried yet.
Oh. But he cut up bodies and put them in pots.
That's the allegation, that he killed people, dismembered them, and put them in flower pots and buried them.
That's horrific.
Creative.
Well, let's not give him any positive feedback on that, please.
Okay.
It's just creepy and gross.
Bet it is.
Okay.
All right. The second voicemail is from Tammy.
All right, Tammy.
Hi, Jill and Dick. First, I want to tell you how great you two are at this podcasting thing. You're the one podcast that I listen to as soon as Tuesday rolls around. I heard Jill's plea for voicemails, and I'm not going to lie. Thought of a free t-shirt for my favorite podcast made me do some research for a case suggestion. And since I'm calling from the Ottawa, Ontario, Canada area, I thought I'd pick an Ottawa case. Interestingly, it was one of the first high-profile uses of DNA in the city. This is a case of poor young Paul Bourigneau, Jr. He had been found in a box, sexually abused, brutalized, and murdered. Little Paul was at the center of a custody battle, and had been left alone with his uncle while his father stayed over at his girlfriend's. It took almost 3 months before anyone was charged with Paul's murder, and the trial had to be relocated due to the intense public attention. I'm hoping there's enough information on the case for you to cover. As for a beer, I'm sorry, everyone, but I'm a stout drinker. I'd like to suggest a beer from Bose, which is just east of the city in Van Cleek Hill, Ontario. Tom Green Milk Stout is one of my all-time favorite beers from Bose, and it's delicious. Thanks again for all you do. I love the Quiet Inn. Thank you.
Thanks, Tammy.
Yes, thanks for the suggestion.
So what were you able to find out about Paul?
Well, Tammy pretty much outlines it. In June of 1989, Sergeant Alan Windsor was one of several officers looking for this missing toddler. This is a little boy who was at the center of a custody dispute, and he had been left home alone with his uncle by his father, who decided to sleep over at his girlfriend's house. So, and the boy disappeared, and they're trying to find him. So Sergeant Windsor's one of 30 or more detectives looking for the boy. He saw an out-of-place box on top of a dumpster near the boy's home. And when he opened the box, he saw a green garbage bag, and upon opening the bag, found the brutalized and sexually abused young Paul.
Oh.
So they found him fairly quickly.
That's heartbreaking.
An autopsy showed the boy had been savagely sodomized and strangled with a leather belt. It took nearly 3 months before his uncle Claude was charged for the boy's murder, and 2 more years before he was convicted. This case, as Tammy suggested or said, was one of the first high-profile uses of DNA. Semen gathered from the boy's bed was connected to his uncle and used as evidence during the trial. Claude Bourgeoneau was sentenced to life in prison for the crime.
Wow, his own uncle.
Yeah.
How horrific.
Well, and his father left him there.
Yeah. We don't know how much his father knew about the uncle, so I don't know what to say about that without knowing more.
Well, I don't either. My suggestion is just that the father knew what the uncle was capable of.
Well, I would hate to think that, but it is possible.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the Wineville murders. I feel like relatives knew what that guy was capable of.
Yeah.
Still, they sent Sanford Clark with him. So it's certainly possible, but not knowing, I just wouldn't say. All right, we have another voicemail from Carol.
This is Carol.
Let's hear it.
Hi, Dick and Jill. My name is Carol, and I live in Midland County, Michigan. First and foremost, I want to let you know that I love your show and can't wait till Tuesdays when I can listen, especially since I Googled up your pictures and you look just as I thought you would. So now when I listen, I see your thoughtful, handsome faces sitting at the Quiet End telling your stories directly to me. I have a case suggestion and a beer suggestion for you. The case suggestion starts in October of 2001 when 20-year-old Levi Highsmith, walking from a community mental health facility, tortured and killed 3 innocent people. The victims were an elderly woman, her disabled daughter, and their caregiver. He was seeking crisis counseling services from the facility and had described delusions regarding training to kill Osama bin Laden. While the counselor had assessed him as a danger to himself and others, he failed to contact the police for an escort to the hospital and let Levi leave the facility because he said he would go to the hospital himself and had a ride. What is most tragic is not only were there the 3 victims, but that Levi lacked appropriate counsel and ended up pleading to second-degree murder. He received 60 to 90 years and is currently serving his time in Muskegon Correctional Facility. Clearly, this man was mentally ill and should be in a mental health hospital getting treatment. Also, what is interesting is that the true events were swept under the rug in a very conservative town. The beer suggestion would be anything from Midland Brewing Company. Keep up the good work, and thank you.
Thank you, Carol. So here we have a failure of a system, or at least a failure of someone working in a system. Just ends in tragedy for 4 people.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I don't have anything really to add from what Carol already stated. I'm wondering if any charges were brought against the counselor at the mental health clinic.
I doubt it. What would you charge her with?
I'd figure out something. I mean, if he or she said that they basically took Highsmith's word for it, that he'd get himself to the mental health facility, that's just ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, she probably or he probably should lose their job or their license. If it's as simple as that, we don't know, but...
We don't. We'll look into it.
But it is a tragedy. Now, what about the beer? Did you respond about the other beer, the Bose beer?
I didn't respond about Bo's beer.
Do you want to say anything about that one?
So, belatedly.
Okay.
We've had some Bo's beers. I've had the Bo's Lughead Lager or something like that. It's very nice.
Well, this is our winner.
And if you recall, what, early on, a couple years ago now, our first year of doing this podcast, we asked people to submit their beer reviews.
Yeah, we got such great entries.
And we had some good ones. And the woman who won talked about Bo's.
And sent us a couple drinking glasses, which we still have. They're great glasses.
They are.
And then Carol had mentioned anything, the beer.
Carol had mentioned the brewery, Midland Brewery, I think.
Yeah, but I thought the name of the beer was Anything.
Yeah, and I haven't tried any Midland beers yet.
So we don't know anything about anything.
I don't know anything about anything.
Okay, well, we'll look into that too.
Okay.
Okay, is that it for voicemails, or do we have one more?
One more from Angela.
Jeez, I'm just inundated. It's really great. Plus, we have a few for next week already, so.
We do.
So the next one is from who?
This is from Angela.
Okay.
And she also gives us a case suggestion.
Perfect. Let's hear it.
Hi, Dick and Jill. My name is Angela Stoddard, and I live in Milford, Ohio. As a new listener, I have been listening to some of the cases that are familiar to me first. One of those was the Jeffrey McDonald case from Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Having lived in that area for 10 years, I had the opportunity to learn about those murders as well as another brutal family murder that occurred there in the 80s. I came across it when my now ex-husband was stationed in Fort Bragg and we were looking to buy a home just outside of the base. My coworkers told me that a murder had happened in the neighborhood that we were looking, so I looked into it because I didn't want to purchase that particular house. This crime occurred in 1985. Neighbors discovered the bodies of Catherine Eastburn and two of her daughters, and also an infant who was still alive, barely, but unharmed in her crib. The family was discovered days after the crime because Catherine's husband, a soldier, was away in training at the time. There's a great deal of information on this case, the investigation and trials, for you guys to delve into. But the short of it is that Tim Hennis, also a soldier, answered an ad to adopt the Eastburn's dog. And upon learning that Mr. Eastburn was away in training, he came back to the home to rape Catherine and ended up murdering her and the two girls. Now, during his first trial, he was found guilty, but after appeals, he was granted a second trial in which he was found not guilty. So he resumed his life and even retired from the military. Then in 2006-2007, the case was reopened after new DNA tests linked him to the murders from the semen sample that was taken from Catherine. So the military called him back into active duty to be tried for the murders through military jurisdiction, so double jeopardy would not be a factor. In 2010, he was found guilty and is currently on death row now. There is a book and a movie that were made on this case before the new DNA evidence surfaced and the third trial occurred. This case has a great deal of depth to it, and I would just love to hear you guys cover it from the quiet end. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Angela. Sounds like Angela's already done all our research for us, Dick.
Yeah, I don't have to summarize what Angela said.
No, I think we could just put her on the payroll right now.
We will. But we've been interested in the Eastburn murders, and it was something that we got more interested in when we were doing the McDonald case, because it does have sort of similar overtones with a woman and daughter's children being murdered.
Sure.
And the fascinating thing was how he had been tried, convicted, overturned on appeal, and found innocent.
Well, yeah, it has some similarities, but it also is very different, and there's a lot more to it.
There is.
Yeah, so.
So we are doing it, and we've got it scheduled for a couple months from now, early January next year.
Yep.
So stay tuned, Angela.
Yep, that one will definitely be covered.
Okay. On to the emails.
Okay.
This first one's a long one.
You want me to read it, or you want to read it?
It's your call.
It's mine.
You're going to do it. This is from last week. We did a case suggestion from Corey and Kelly, a husband and wife who like to listen to us. And this is their second case suggestion. And there's also some comment that they have. So all yours, Jill.
But no comments that I'm not going to want to read.
Right.
Okay. Corey and Kelly write, "The second case involves a precious, innocent, and defenseless child. This child should have been protected, nurtured, loved, educated, and respected. What this child received was neglect, intolerance, lack of patience, physical abuse, and a heinous burial at the hands of his mother and stepfather, mom's common-law husband. This case is very difficult due to the fact that it involves the death of a 5-year-old child, Jordan Rodriguez, son of Larissa Rodriguez and stepson of Christopher Rodriguez. Larissa had 10 children, many of whom she didn't have custody of. It would be interesting to hear Jill's very compassionate yet matter-of-fact perspective and Dick's expertise in the area of pediatrics. So often a child is stripped of the ability to be a physically and emotionally healthy adult just based on the environment he/she was raised in. Our granddaughter has a pediatrician mom and a neurosurgeon dad, so the introspect of this case would be appreciated. Our little granddaughter is also the blonde, loud, hugging everyone silly girl at the synagogue every Saturday. Don't get us started about the baby. We would go on for paragraphs. Why are so many parents unfazed or desensitized to the killing of their children when we are intrinsically driven to protect our offspring? Understanding that our culture is over-sexualized and overstimulated by an indulgent environment, do people choose a partner over offspring? Is attention, acceptance, and validation of oneself a replacement for parental obligation? Is it poor parenting that is at the root cause of these deaths? Is it selfishness, neediness? How could this sweet soul be so brutally abused at the hands of his own caregivers and buried in an unmarked grave in the backyard in order to avoid detection? Our own children are grown adults and still receive the sweet, loving, and nurturing support and devotion of their parents. Should our American culture be digging into our souls to be parents who reject impulse and teach only proactive solutions? We say yes. Nurture, guide, love, educate, support, personal identity, and individuality. Enjoy your New Mexico quiet end and cheers to fabulous beers. Well, thank you, Corey and Kelly. A really thought-provoking email. Now let's talk a little bit about the case. A veteran judge for the first time in her career broke down in tears as she sentenced a man and woman who killed a 5-year-old boy and buried his body in an unmarked grave in their backyard. Common Pleas Court, Judge Nancy Margaret Russo sentenced Larissa Rodriguez to 25 years in prison, and minutes later the judge could no longer contain her tears as she looked at photographs of the little boy's body before she sentenced Christopher Rodriguez. I know as a judge I'm not supposed to show emotion, and in 22 years I never have, Russo said quietly. But this is one of the worst things I've ever seen in my life. I don't know how you live with yourself, she said to Larissa Rodriguez and Christopher Rodriguez, who each pleaded guilty to charges of involuntary manslaughter, felonious assault, child endangering, and the gross abuse of a corpse in Jordan's death. The plea was part of a deal with prosecutors and allowed the couple to avoid trial for murder, which carries a potential life sentence. While prosecutors and defense lawyers for the couple agreed to a recommended sentence of between 20 and 25 years for both of them. But the judge, after breaking down in tears, rejected that recommendation for Christopher Rodriguez, and she sentenced him to the maximum of 28 years in prison. Whatever this child's life was supposed to be, she said, you made sure it didn't happen. Jordan was actually 26 weeks premature and had only one kidney when he was born. He was one of 9 children that Larissa had. The boy's aunt and uncle wrote a letter that said they tried to intervene and get help for Jordan. But Larissa and Christopher Rodriguez always rebuffed them. They recalled that the last time they saw the boy, he ran to his uncle when he came home from work and ate a family dinner on his lap. Jordan was a special, sweet little boy who would have developed and bloomed into a special soul. When he died, they just decided to bury him in the backyard. They put mothballs in the bags they wrapped him in to keep animals from digging him up. The boy's death went unreported for 2 months until Cleveland police received a tip. So, tragic case.
It is, isn't it?
I do like the idea of discussing the social aspects of parenting. What do you think? Yeah. I mean, we have done similar cases with child services being involved and kids that fall through the cracks. And they're some of the most heartbreaking cases we've done.
They are. We've talked about these things, and I'm only half joking when I say that you shouldn't just be able to have kids. You ought to have a license or something. There ought to be some committee.
Right. I agree.
But yeah, I mean, there's certainly fragile parents in our society that need all the help they can get. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, maybe most of the time, it's not available to them.
Right. But this is the kind of case, if you do an episode on something like this, it makes for a very rough week, if not a rough year, just thinking about it and dealing with the details of it. So I really have to, my heart goes out to judges and police officers and people who are actually dealing hands-on with these things. You know, how do you cope with that? It's a real sacrifice in your life to deal with these sorts of things.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
I also like the comment that Corey and Kelly threw in at the end about basically parenting, it doesn't stop when your children get to be adults.
Oh, sure. I mean, we know that.
Don't we? Yeah, I will look more into that. I think it's probably a case we'd be interested in doing, but it's going to be tough to do.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, the next email is from Alana. I'm going to let you read this one. It's a comment on Paolo Macarini.
Yeah, the next two are comments on Paolo.
Okay. This one's from friend of the show, Alana. This is the same Alana who's written before, right?
Alana likes us, and okay. You know, we like Alana. So she says, I wasn't familiar with this case, but can see why it interested you. His con took in many smart, degreed people, and it is a cautionary tale for rigorous scientific documentation for a baffle-gab. I like that word.
Me too.
I too consider it murder, especially as he falsified his data and his patients suffered terribly and died. No Hippocratic oath of first do no harm practiced here. More baffling, as he could have had a career as a skilled functioning doctor. I wonder how early in his life his BSing started, because he seemed quite skilled at it by the time he starts gaining notice and permission for his tracheal procedure. I think the comparison to Dr. Joseph Mengele is apt. Both remain free. Hard to understand why he didn't get charged, even with manslaughter. But I suppose that would have embarrassed some people, including the Karolinska Institute. Not much info on this, so I'm thinking your podcast might help to create some dust stirring and discomfort for Macchiarini, as he deserves. Many thanks for another excellent episode.
Well, thanks, Alana.
And do you want to talk about David's comment or read David's comment?
Sure. I just wanted to say one thing about Alana's is why he didn't go to jail. I mean, there are poor people who steal a TV and go to jail for a long time. And he killed people. But because he's a wealthy doctor, I feel like that's a big part of why he got away with it.
Well, remember, though, they're still reviewing some charges and he might be charged again.
He might be, but he sure is getting away with a lot, don't you think?
He has so far, yes.
Okay, David's comment on the same case.
Yeah, I put David's in because this is a scientist who's actually done some research.
Oh, great.
And he can address a couple things. He can address why Paolo's scaffold of plastic wasn't going to work, and he can also address the rigorous testing that needs to be done.
So you gave this one to me because there are words in here I'll have trouble pronouncing and you can laugh?
No, I didn't do that.
All right. So David says, hey guys, the science or lack thereof in using plastic as a scaffolding for human tissue is pretty unbelievable. I used to work in a preclinical research facility and all of our research had to be funded through some organization like NIH, Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, or some other similar source. Also, an IRB had to review anything that was going into a human. Do European countries not use similar methods in getting research approved? We also used good lab practices when recording data. If we wrote an animal's weight, sorry, Jill, we used rats, bunnies, pigs, and sheep, on our hand, so as not to forget, we had to photocopy the hand for GLP data. For one project, a researcher wanted to test PTFE, Gore-Tex, against bovine urinary matrix as a myocardial patch, which would be in the heart myocardial.
Correct.
Once the patches were in place, stem cells were introduced. After 3 months, we sacked the pigs and all kinds of histologic tests were done, and it turned out UBM was superior to PTFE. UBM was an excellent scaffold for angiogenesis. The PTFE, after 3 months, was not absorbed. It was rigid, and surrounding myocardium was necrotic, as a revascularization never happened. I am leaving out many steps and information to keep it shortish. If we tried PTFE in a human, how many people involved in the research would be in prison? But then again, doctors and surgeons in particular get away with malpractice sometimes. What do you say, Dr. Dick?
We couldn't have said this any better. The highlight was that the urinary bovine matrix could serve as a scaffold for angiogenesis, and the plastic, not in the least. Mm-hmm. So,
They didn't go ahead and put them in people.
They didn't even try that.
No.
Not like Paolo. So that was a great letter.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Dave.
Thanks, David. Okay, last one. Case suggestion from Liz. She wonders if we have heard of the company Theranos. I think that's the pronunciation. There's a book that describes the fraud. John Carreyrou wrote a book called Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup. Having grown up in Silicon Valley, it of course sparked my interest. Elizabeth Holmes, who was a Stanford dropout, swindled companies and prominent people such as George Shultz and Henry Kissinger. George Shultz's grandson was the whistleblower, and even then his grandfather did not believe him. I'm sure Dick could find a nice Northern California beer to review and could explain why this innovative way of drawing blood would be good or bad.
So what did you find out about this? I don't know if you have, but I've never heard of it.
Yeah, we saw 60 Minutes.
Oh, did we?
Episode.
I don't remember.
Well, it was one of 60, you know, 20 minutes of it. It was really cool, in a sense. It's kind of similar to Paolo. The person who founded this company.
Theranos,
Elizabeth Holmes. She claimed that she had developed devices to automate and miniaturize blood tests using microscopic blood volumes.
Wow, that would be handy, wouldn't it?
It would. So you'd need...
Especially in pediatrics, when you try and draw their blood and you just get a tiny little bit. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they dubbed its blood collection vessel the Nanotainer and its analysis machine the Edison. The technology has been criticized for not being peer-reviewed. They claim to have data verifying the accuracy and reliability of its tests. That would be published in February 2016. And they announced that it would permit the Cleveland Clinic to complete a validation study of its technology. So this happened, and there's an article that appeared in the Journal of Clinical Investigation. And it was stated that the company's blood test results were flagged outside their normal range 1.5 times more often than other testing services.
Well, that makes them just invalid, and there's no point in it.
That most of its lab measurements evaluated showed significant inter-service variability, that lipid test results between Theranos and other clinical services were non-equivalent. This is, again, similar to Paolo, rapid rise, rapid fall
yeah.
from grace.
But they didn't kill anybody.
No, they didn't, not that we know of. But they got lots of people invest in this scam.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's kind of running another pyramid scheme. And it probably would be a good thing to do, maybe sometime in the next year.
Well, maybe. I mean, my only thought is, with Paolo, he actually killed people. And in a true crime podcast, are we really going to get into just straight out fraud?
Yeah.
Because most of our cases are actually violence, murder. Yeah, I'm not saying it's out of the range of possibility, but it is very different from what we do.
Let me check on, get some more info and see if we can find some.
Okay.
I'll bring it back.
All right, sure.
Okay. But those are good discussions.
Oh, great feedback. You're just really making feedback so much better. I'm glad I handed it over to you. And thank you, everyone. If you did have your voicemail read today, don't forget to email me with your address and your preferred shirt size.
So we'll pack it in today?
Yes, I think we've done enough for today.
Then we'll work on another episode?
Sure.
And we'll see you at the quiet end.
All right. We'll see you at the quiet end. Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.